This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Our three speakers. Our first speaker will be Hitomi Toku, who is a cultural officer from the Australian Embassy in Tokyo. Now, I think that official designation is absolutely no indication at all of the importance of Hitomi to this exhibition. Hitomi was a translator at an enormous range of levels. She translated language for Margot when Margot was dealing with the Japanese, but she also translated cultures. Hitomi was really the key pivotal mediator in the cross-cultural experience Australia-Japan, Japan-Australia. And this exhibition, I think it's very fair to say, I don't think Margot would disagree, would not have taken place in the way that it did without Hitomi's dedication and commitment, which went way beyond her 9-to-5 job. I think that now that it's left Japan, I think she might actually get a weekend off here or there.
Actually, this is my day off. I'm brought to work, so...
this is not work compared to what you've had to do.
So, sitting to Hitomi's right is Ajioka Chiaki, and...
not the visitor.
Chiaki is an art historian, an art curator, living in Sydney now, and she did translations for many, many years for Japanese movies on SBS, which is how I've come to meet her. And to her right is Mayumi Uchida, who was also very, very intimately involved in this exhibition and its tour to Japan, because Mayumi had a lot of the responsibility for bridging the path of community members from Utopia to Japan, and I think the exhibition owes a huge debt of gratitude to Mayumi. So.
Thank you.
Mayumi had triple cultural barriers to cross. She was. Truly, I have to add this. She's had long-term association with Barbara Weir and other members of the Utopia community, and has taken many Japanese people there, and had lots of other projects with many other communities, Indigenous communities through the centre. So she is really well versed in how to look after them in the way they need to be, yet service the needs of the very opposing cultural demands of. You know, of here or Japan or wherever. And it's extraordinary. And she's right to the point of feeding them, ironing their clothes, everything, you know. So she has to fly to Utopia, gets them, helps them, you know, with their clothes and their medications and doctoring needs, and just unbelievable, and ensures that everybody's happy on both sides, and the needs from you know, community's sense of time and place and commitment's quite different than what, you know, we might require in the West or what the Japanese might require. So it was an amazingly complex exercise, and a very, very important one to this exhibition and to here. So this time we kind of let her off the hook a bit, and the Utopians were organised mostly assisted by people in the museum, so she had a little bit of a break. But it's deepened her contacts even more with the families.
I'm just a mad Japanese, that's all. Just love Aboriginal people.
Yeah. Now, I gather, Hitomi, you have a PowerPoint.
Yes.
So we'll hear from Hitomi first, and then we'll have discussion among the panel. Thank you.
They didn't require anyone here to write a paper. Just thought we'd just... I think they all have, of course, they're Japanese, and they're always very prepared and conscientious. Oh, well. Oh, they have notes, sorry. But they're not required. It really was to be a conversation and just even responding to what was seen up there. And each of them have obviously taken a special interest and heard stuff and gone to blog sites that are in Japanese that we can't unlock, and I've heard many stories from each of them about certain reactions. So I think that's, you know, you feel can feel perfectly comfortable just to talk about things you saw and heard without, you know, feeling on the spot as you are.
So that means I can talk a bit of rubbish.
You can talk rubbish if you want.
Okay.
If you're capable of talking rubbish.
Okay, so good morning, everyone. First of all, I'd just like to say it's a great honour for me to participate in this forum at the National Museum of Australia. Thank you, Marco, for inviting me. Nevertheless, I must say that actually my main role as a culture officer at the Australian Embassy in Tokyo is to promote Australian culture in Japan. So I really don't have that much academic background or material to talk about the Japanese responses to the exhibition, but if sharing any knowledge I may have with you today, this morning, might contribute to the understanding of between Japan and Australia. It's a great honour and I'm very happy to do so. So rather than analysing the Japanese audience reactions immediately, I would like to talk about my personal views on why we were able to make the MILA exhibition in Japan such a success. The total numbers of the visitors to the MILA exhibition in Japan was 124,664. And as Mr. Tadehata said in his video message yesterday, this number was higher than that of the retrospective of Andy Warhol held in 96 in Tokyo. So this is one of the reasons why we think that the MILA exhibition in Japan was such a success. But when I started working at the embassy in April 2004, I had been informed that Mr. Tadehata, who was an art university professor at the time, was a bit disappointed that an MILA exhibition project didn't go on and it had been cancelled. But when I asked him, he said that he was still personally very, very interested in MILA's works. So on my familiarisation trip to Australia in June 2004, I was told to visit the major art institutions in Australia in order to explore the meek possibilities of reviving the project. And that was the first time I met with Margot, and she showed me the 98 exhibition catalogue with the images of the frames painted by Emily. And that was when I thought that actually this might work in Japan. With the little knowledge that I have, I'm aware that a picture frame is an important element when discussing paintings in the history of Western art. And if avant-garde art has been a process of overcoming the existing framework, one might be able to say that the Japanese artists had to overcome two obstacles to be considered equal in Western art history. Since the Meiji Restoration in 1868, when Japan opened its door to other countries, the Japanese had to first master Western art, and it was only then that one could start thinking about creating something original. But when I saw the MILA painted frames, they seemed to so easily overcome all these complexities, and that one could find there nothing but an expression of limitless creativity. Another thought I had about the frame is that Japan, compared to Australia, is probably a more minutely controlled society. The greater Tokyo's population is said to be approximately 34 million, and I remember how the Australian couriers were amazed at seeing the busy Tokyo station that 3.6 million people use every day. So it is understandable that in order to function, the society needs some degree of control. And after the war, all Japanese shared the same objective, which was to become economically rich. However, since the economic crisis in the early 90s, many Japanese seem to have lost their meaning of life. Japan has one of the highest suicide rates in the world. It is also an aging society. So under the increasing pressure from the society, people seem to be at a loss and not know how to break away from the rules and values imposed. So when I started learning more about Emily and her works, I thought that this may give the Japanese an opportunity to think about their identity and ask themselves if they were able to appreciate the works without necessarily having full knowledge of the artist's background or of her reputation. At the same time, the challenges exist as well. There is still strong tendency among the Japanese to follow the others. The Japanese love famous artists like the Impressionists, and we have French and Italian exhibitions all the time. There is no risk in going to an Impressionist exhibition, as it would mean that everyone will approve of your good taste. But I wonder how many people know that the Impressionists were rebellions when they first held the exhibition in 1874. So Australian art, including Indigenous art, was in fact a bit of a problem. For example, there were a couple of Australian artists art exhibitions in the past, and the Australian Aboriginal art exhibition that I believe Mayumi was really involved in had approximately 26,000 visitors. The PRISM Contemporary Australian Art exhibition held in central Tokyo had approximately 15,500 visitors. So all these were very, very good exhibitions, but the numbers of visitors remained relatively small. So I know that the Japanese involved in the Emily project had a belief in her works. Thus, the biggest challenge was not so much about what was shown inside the gallery, but how to get people come to see the works. We also knew that Emily would have many competing exhibitions, without mentioning all the various entertainment offered in Tokyo. So this is all the list of exhibitions that was going on at the same time as Emily's. So thus, I believe that one of the key factors of the success was that we had the best partners to realise the exhibition. I cannot thank more Mr. Morton of the National Museum of Australia for giving his support to the total support to the project, allowing all his amazing staff to work on it. And as for the Japanese, we had the National Museum of Art, Osaka, of whose director Mr. Tadahata had become in 2005. However, the embassy worked very, very hard to convince the Yomiuri Shimbun and the National Arts Centre to officially come on board. The Yomiuri Shimbun is Japan's largest daily newspaper with a circulation of 11 million. The partnership with them meant that we would have more publicity. If we wanted to place an advertisement like this, which they did on the opening day of the Tokyo exhibition, it would normally cost more than 300,000 Australian dollars. So we could have never done that. And as for the National Arts Centre Tokyo, it was not even open when the embassy had preliminary discussions with them. But we knew that it would attract people and that Emily's work would look spectacular in their 2,000 square metre, 8-metre high ceiling gallery. It was also important for us to show Emily's works in the only two national institutions with a focus on contemporary art. So even after a number of bottles of wines, actually the embassy was able to convince the two organisations that we knew that would bring people to the exhibition. However, there was another problem. In the beginning, Yomiuri was quite pessimistic about the numbers, so the initial promotional budget was quite limited. So all the partners decided to do everything we could. The embassy, of course, financially contributed the publicity, but also sent out flyers to schools and organised lectures at university by Margot and Miss Butler, who spoke yesterday. We especially also wanted NHK, the Japanese national broadcaster, to produce a 45 feature on Emily and her works on its influential arts programme. We repeatedly received negative answers from NHK, so I went to them 5 times, and after 8 months, they finally agreed to do it, and it was done especially with the cooperation with Chiaki, Mayumi, and all the community, Utopia community members, so I'd like to thank them here. Also, in addition, we organised a function inviting 140 important arts and media contacts at the National Arts Centre, Tokyo, to coincide with the Prime Minister Rudd's viewing of the exhibition. And in addition, we also lobbied the Crown Prince to see the show. And finally, not only him, but also the princess came. So all the media, including the rivals of Yomiuri, carried the story. And our final effort ended by having the empress to come to see the exhibition just before it finished. But obviously, it wasn't only the embassy. The National Arts Centre Tokyo also contributed significantly by organising Indigenous music workshops, dance events, tours for disabled people. The Yomiuri Shimbun also did its best. It successfully placed transit advertisements whose value would normally be probably more than 800,000 Australian dollars. So there were posters and flyers and trains and stations all over Tokyo. And in addition, by using your news channels of publicity, many articles appeared in various media. Neither of the two art galleries nor the embassy would have ever been able to secure such amount of exposure on our own. Therefore, with the efforts by all partners combined, we had an event every week. We also had a lot of articles and advertisements coming out of all through the exhibition period. You can see here how the numbers of the visitors increased day by day. So I cannot stress more that the success of the exhibition was due to this wonderful collaboration amongst all the partners. On the last day of the show in Tokyo, we wandered the gallery filled with people, and we were very, very moved. So I'd just like to conclude that without all the efforts by everyone involved in the project, the exhibition would have never been a success. However, this was only possible because Emily's works themselves had the power and strength that the Japanese had never seen before in their lives. In particular, the curators of the National Arts Centre Tokyo, with Margo and all the other Australian staff, made its best effort to use out of the huge White Cube Gallery. Many people wrote about the experience in their blogs, and some even said that they felt that the National Arts Centre Tokyo was specifically built to show Emily's works. And some people wrote that they did not find the same difficulties with Emily's works that they had with other abstract art. Some even said that it seemed useless to compare Emily with Monet or other Western masters. And many people commented that they were amazed by the fact that there were no prescribed orientation and that Emily's works could be hung in any way. Eden Corkill, an English art journalist, starts his article in Freeze magazine online. What's the easiest way for an artist to get noticed in Japan? Hold an exhibition in New York. Also, the saying went for a long time. It was true for both Japanese and foreign artists, including those who were much further from the American coastline to Tokyo. A stunning, beautiful and astounding, ambitious retrospective for the Australian Aboriginal artist Emily Cumming Wari, currently show at the National Arts Centre Tokyo, is providing that the old adage is well and truly dead and suggesting that perhaps for the first time, Japanese curators are learning to cut their own paths through the global cultural landscape. And he concludes, this is more than an extraordinarily beautiful exhibition for an extraordinarily gifted artist. It is a watershed in Japanese museum history. So the exhibition was an opportunity for both the Japanese art world and the audience to go outside of the Euro-American mainstream and connect with the artworks by themselves. So finally, I think it was not so much about Indigenous or contemporary, Australian or Japanese. Emily's works transcend, and I believe that people saw something fundamental for all human beings or creatures in the works. Emily's works just seem to have the capacity to allow many, many layers of understanding. This discovery was such a relief to the Japanese who had always thought that they had to look at art in a certain way and live in a certain way. They felt that beyond the ego of the artist, Emily was sharing her knowledge of life with them. So people were given the energy and hope to continue to live. I feel very privileged to be able to witness such a wonderful moment, and I hope I was able to share some of these exciting moments with you today. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tony. That was wonderful. Thanks. We'll now have a discussion, I think, between the panelists here. Jackie, would you like to start with some of your own observations?
Okay, well, I'm not sure what else I can say after Hitomi's very eloquent speech. So mine is very, very short. I just want to tell you about my understanding of Japanese response that I sort of gathered by taking my own friends and a few friends past some other the people's comments on the emails and some blog search as well. So in short, I think the two things that really I find striking was, first of all, the perhaps as you can see from the interviews, that the Japanese museum goers are very sophisticated. And also, secondly, but on the other hand, their response is very almost primordial experience that they were expressing. And that's only two things I want to say, but perhaps I need a little more explanation. By sophisticated audience, well, Hitomi has already told you about the competing entertainment and other major exhibitions. Well, they are constantly exposed to exhibitions, Western arts from all ages, major masterpieces, and from major museums of Europe and America constantly being shown somewhere in Japan. And at the same time, the very good Japanese art from ancient to contemporary also being shown constantly. And of course, Chinese and other Asian art, they are also shown constantly. So the actually museum, individual museum goers, actually going to different, these different art from different cultures constantly, okay, and making their own mind. So that's the audience that they have in Japan. And being what I meant by saying, saying primordial experience is that it seems to me from the reactions that Emily's work really triggered a collective memory of our relationship with the land by showing her relationship with hers. And by collecting collective memory, I mean that it's something that's shared, but also it's an experience itself is very personal, like Professor Tatehata was like struggling to express. It's something very personal and even very private. And in that, the reason perhaps for the responses being so direct was, I think I found some of the things that from yesterday's talks, examples that I could just pick up was that John Mandin's talking about smoking ceremony, that he was surprised at the smoking ceremony, which didn't do anything in Australia, and Japanese people lining up to be blessed. And of course, if you go to Asakusa district in Tokyo, a temple, there's a huge incense burner constantly producing the smoke, and the people are just going there, washing their heads to be blessed. And that's very natural reaction. And also, Sally Butler talked about the Aboriginal culture not having distinction between art and craft. That's exactly the same with Japan. The distinction between art and craft is sort of settled, artificially set according to Western standard, and that was set around 1900 to adjust to Western notion, but wider community still values objects according to their own merit of individual, actually, pieces, rather than the concept of whether it's painting, therefore it's more important. And another thing was also pattern making coming relating to this appreciation of sort of so-called craft work, like textile. I remember when I took a friend of mine to the Tokyo exhibition, the first room she saw this big yam, that the pink one that was shown vertically. And as we moved to next, the section that it displayed batik, the work, Emily's, and she said, oh, that makes sense. Because the first, and she said, when I first saw that big yam, immediately, oh, textile. And of course, she had no sort of, value judgment. It's just the something that's attractive and that reminded her of textile pattern. And also nature worship in the, I thought was really funny that watching the NHK program that Hitomi mentioned, the narration says, oh, in Aboriginal culture, everything in nature has a spirit. And I thought, well, the Japanese have that too. And Japanese even have, consider the even man-made objects have a spirit. I just say something very personal, because I can say any quite a lot of examples about that, but something very personal. I have my father, who was a very progressive thinker, and he was, as a senior public servant, he was involved in modernizing one whole large government organization. Some years ago, when I visited him, I helped him sort of clean up the house, and there was very dusty, sort of little plastic, some sort of figure. I can't remember if it was a cat or some sort of one of those things that come with sweet, the packets in sweets that the that was given to him by my niece, and that had been sitting there for 5-6 years and gathering dust. And I told him, well, why don't you throw this out? And he said, well, I've been wanting to do that, but I feel that it might appear in my dream and resenting it. And that's so natural to feel that way. And other primordial reactions, some of the, from the comments that I picked up are things like powerful, that virtually everybody says how powerful Emily's paintings were. And someone also said, but it's very powerful but non-threatening. Or others said it just felt drawn into it, and it was very difficult to move from, like physically move out of it. And also comments like I felt recharged or energized, as you saw in one of the comments. And the way I interpret it is that perhaps this sort of impact was particularly strong, as Hitomi explained, that in Osaka and Tokyo, it's a very urban environment, and every day very unnatural sort of everyday life, squeezing into crowded trains every day and living in this concrete jungle, if you like. So where in this sort of situation, he did have some sort of buzzword at the moment in Japan is like healing effect, like healing is from big thing, and Emily's work really struck right chord in it. So I think in John's work, they were reading the sign. I think that's about. Say sorry.
Thank you.
To take time.
Thank you. Thank you. Mayumi. I know you.
Do I have to speak this
long? Yeah. No.
One
of the interesting things about the exhibition is of course, that in Japan, the indigenous context was very low-key. There was information about the indigenous context, but it was in mainly in the catalogue and in the Utopia Room in Osaka. The Utopia Room was on another floor from the exhibition, so it might have been easy to bypass it. In Tokyo, it was in a room right at the back, and again, it could have been quite easily bypassed. So a lot of the responses and the very warm, enthusiastic response and emotional responses are not necessarily dependent on knowledge of the indigenous context in which the paintings were made or knowledge about Emily herself. And I think that a lot of the responses are very interesting in that they are searching for points of identification between Japanese culture and the artworks without the indigenous context being in the foreground. Does that help you at all in coming up with some thoughts that might help us here? Because you're very...
Not at all.
But you're...
No, it's... excuse my English. It's... I went to see the exhibition when I was in Tokyo for 5 times because I had a free tickets. So I felt that all the audience really stood up, you know, in front of every single paintings. And then one gentleman, young gentleman, was crying. So because I talked to everybody, so I asked the gentleman, are you okay? Of course you don't know me, I'm a stranger, but are you okay? He said, I don't understand Aboriginal art at all, but I felt very warm, and then I feel like I've been like surrounded by warmth and energy, this painter, Emily. And then he said he doesn't normally go to see art exhibition at all, but at that time, that was his 10th time, you know? So I was almost to, you know, give him a free ticket as well. And then, yes, even people don't know anything about Emily, Aboriginal art. Never heard of Aboriginal art and never heard of Emily Carmen Worry, but people just enjoyed to see Emily's personality through the paintings. Because Emily's painting don't really have to think in a head, just myself. Painting just tell, you know, everything, and then people just feel from the heart. So no need to be explained, you know, at all. That's what I felt. And I could see from all the audience at the art center. And then because I went to see the show 5 times, I normally catch a taxi from the Tokyo station because I don't have to get there by subway. So I called a taxi, and a taxi driver asked me the way to go. And then art center in Tokyo. Always, you know, I talk to everybody. So I talked to taxi driver, do you know what's happening there? And he said, no. And I explained to the taxi driver about Emily. And he's seen the documentary of NHK TV, and then he was so excited. And then he said, I'm going to see the exhibition with my family next week. So I gave him the free tickets. This is great. And then, yes, I wanted to share with you that my personal story that I was lucky enough to have opportunity to meet Emily in 1996, the 6 months before she passed away. That was just a wonderful experience for my life. And then first things, you know, when I meet Emily, I said hello to her. And then she hold my hands and then ask me that, how many grandchildren I have. I don't even have a husband, so I don't have any grandchildren. And she was so funny and warm and energetic. And then I saw her painting, you know, in front of me. And so the audience at the art center could feel Emily's personality through her works, which was, I thought it was wonderful. You know, people don't know anything about Emily Carmen Worry, but people could feel, could see who's Emily is. That's all I can say. Thank you.
Can I add something to it? I totally agree with what Andrew said, and also what Mayumi-san said. But in some of the reactions, that the first reaction, of course, they immediately the audience responded to it. But then they wanted to find out more, and actually that the particular corner of the Aboriginal the culture, and that was very well used, if you like, and a lot of comments included how wonderful it was, and then they felt they knew something about an Aboriginal culture. And actually, I took a friend of mine, and as soon as she walked in, she looked at all the animals, and she couldn't control herself saying, "Oh, cute, isn't it beautiful? It's so beautiful." And I tried to stop her because she was screaming almost. And I felt embarrassed, but she just could not stop it. I think that, well, what was happening was that she could actually feel the whole, again, the energy coming from those figures as well. And also, I just wanted to add that Mayumi-san is an author of a book in Japanese on Aboriginal art. And when I checked with internet, a lot of people after the exhibition, when they heard about the exhibition, I knew that she wasn't going to tell herself, that they actually enhanced their knowledge and experience reading her book as well. So that way, even those who did not read her book, they could, again, had a sort of connection that there's some Japanese who were totally who fell in love with Aboriginal culture, and there's someone doing it. So it's another kind of connection that I think that was very effective in sort of increasing their sort of connection or link emotionally. Thank you.
I think one of the things that I've been pondering as we've been editing the many, many hours we have for this film, over 150 hours, is that I think it's a reflection of the power of the paintings and the sort of the potentials that are in the painting, the potentials to communicate that are in the painting, that the meaning of the paintings, as it were, is so easily Japanized or translated into Japanese by a lot of Japanese viewers who find points of identification in Japanese culture. So this is reverence for nature, which is extremely ironic because the Japanese, like the Australians, are very good at totally desecrating nature and covering nature with concrete and digging it up. But still, we do both share that sort of notional reverence and respond to something in Emily's work relating to that reverence. There's the notion of ritual and ceremony, even though the ceremonies are totally different. The fact of the ceremony and the ritual are there. The points of identification in the colour palettes that Emily used, some of the designs in traditional Japanese art that are identified in aspects of Emily's painting. I think it's really fascinating that Emily's work is so readily translated, as it were, into the Japanese art context. Would you like to comment some more on this, any of you?
Oh. There's not much more than I actually already said. But, for example, it is easily, partly because Emily's work is so direct and abstract, if you have to put describe the style, it is more direct. And the way that it communicates and that relates to the land. For example, I think we looked at some of the festival scenes in yesterday in a short introduction film, and that was in Tokyo, was it? They were carrying this portable shrine through the streets during festival. Now, this sort of festival is specific to one particular locality, and when you take part, that's it is a personal experience, but also the festivals attached to the place, and people come and go, and you know that you come and go, and the festival stays. And that sort of, oops, perhaps the word I shouldn't use is timelessness, or something beyond concept of time. That sort of connection is—it's easy to understand when you see it. Does it make sense?
Yes. Hitomi, do you want to add anything at this point?
The only thing probably I should mention is that that made me think when I was listening to people speaking yesterday was that there are very, very few people who talked about political issues or social issues when they came to the exhibition. So one way you could see that the Japanese don't have that consciousness, which is a pity because we've got minorities as well. But at the same time, probably as I heard in yesterday's discussions, we did, the Japanese didn't have that baggage that probably people here might have, or they, of course, they don't know. They have no idea in what kind of condition Emily lived in, and so they're very. I think there were one or two people who said that. Well, the support by the Australian government means that the government is exploiting this to do something, but that was really a rare comment, and so they didn't think about. So much about that dimension, which might have been made people easier to just look at the artworks and think for themselves.
Any comments or questions from the floor for the panelists? Yeah. Yes. Oh, hang on, there's a microphone. If you could identify yourself too for the record, thank you.
Ian McLean. Hold it there, sorry. Yeah. It doesn't surprise me that more people came to see Emily's show than Andy Warhol. But I'm wondering how many people came to see, you know, the big impressionist exhibitions or the, which your work seemed to be, the advertisements, first ones seemed to be alluding to, you know, big Monet water lilies or something.
I think there was the second exhibition held at the National Arts Centre, Tokyo, was a Claude Monet big retrospective, and I think they had... before Emily. That was probably seven... No, what is it? 700,000, yes.
And was there a Modigliani exhibition on at the same time?
It was at the same time. Just was, before Emily, yeah.
I think it was... 300,000-ish, I think. Yeah. Yes, I think so. But mind you, really, for the Monet exhibition, Yomiuri, he's not here anymore, is he? they had four times bigger publicity budget than the Emily show. And I think the point is that in Japan, contemporary art exhibitions don't get many... Normally, they don't get a lot of audience. So compared to... If you think... You know, Emily as sort of contemporary abstract artist, the number was really phenomenal, and that's what everybody says. So,
just one more from the floor, one more comment or question.
Sorry, I won't hold you up. It's interesting with those figures. My name's John Mundy, who's speaking. Those figures. There's an article in the the Japan Times, in fact, commenting on those high figures, and then, in fact, they're not. I get two messages sent to me every day. One's the Japan Times in English, and one is the art newspaper. That has a list of the best attended shows in the world. And in fact, they don't seem to report those figures from Tokyo at all. It's usually those figures are the highest attended showers in New York or somewhere else. And the article was basically saying they're ignoring the audiences and the intensity of appreciation that happens in Japan. There are two things that I remember in my time in Japan, very limited time. One was this relationship between spirituality and attachment to land and places and with Aboriginal religious beliefs and Japanese Shinto beliefs. But I do remember one day, after being there very little time and seeing some things, seeing some rituals, you were talking about the festivals and saying that Shinto was just like dreaming. And my supervisor very bluntly said, Shinto is not dreaming. There's obviously a few more things. It's the same but different, as we say in Aboriginal terms. There's one other thing, though, that I do remember about Japanese relationships with Australia, that I read somewhere in Japan that one of the biggest selling novels, a love story, in fact, had its culmination in Uluru. What's the name? Can you tell people about that novel? It's one of the biggest selling novels in Japan.
Something called, like, you cry out about love in the centre of the world, which is Uluru, I think.
So it doesn't, the love story doesn't end in Paris or somewhere. It ends actually in the centre of Australia. So the Japanese people obviously see Australia in a very strong attachment away. Just one other thing, your story about the political end of things. I did give a paper to the Australia-Japan Foundation in the embassy, and I think you might have been there. And all I remember is that, in fact, the audience, of quite a large audience, was actually very sophisticated in knowing about political matters to do with Aboriginal people, and yeah, knew a lot about Australia, much more than they were exhibiting in normal conversation. Yeah, that's all.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And thank you to the three panellists. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.